Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
My colleagues in the Senate used to always kid me for quoting Irish poets.
America's new president always recalls his roots. The Irish Prime Minister, Micheál Martin, joins us on Biden, Brexit, and the new era ahead. Plus,
Middle East peace is always a very attractive proposition. It's a very sexy topic.
The personal side of making peace. We go behind the scenes of Israeli-Palestinian negotiations with Dror Morey, director of The Human Factor, plus two key players, Aaron David Miller and Gamal Hilal. Then,
what the president was saying right from the get-go, you know, let's reset this. Let's everybody get on the same page, trust each other, let the science speak.
Let Fauci be Fauci as the new White House starts to stamp out COVID. Andy Slavitt, senior advisor to Biden's response team, joins Hari Srinivasan. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Once again, after four long years, Europe has a friend in the White House. Those words from the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. This week, the EU invited President Joe Biden to a summit focused on shared multilateral goals on COVID and also on the climate. Biden is eager to repair relations overseas, just as he remains focused on pressing domestic needs, most urgently COVID and the economy. It is part of Biden lore that he was born in Pennsylvania, raised in Delaware, and that his ancestral home, Ireland, remains close to his heart. The Irish Prime Minister, the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, welcomed the new American president, saying that he is one of us, part of our global family. And he's joining me now from Dublin. Prime Minister, welcome to the program. So let me start by saying, asking, what does an Irish-American president, obviously he's not the first, but what does this mean for Ireland today?
Well, first of all, it's a source of great pride in Ireland that the great-grandson of an Irish emigrant, and Irish emigrants has become president of the United States of America, a great democracy. And there was genuine elation and joy at his elevation this week across the country. There's also a genuine sense of warmth towards President Biden. People really do appreciate the warmth that he radiates for Ireland in all of his commentary, and indeed in his regular quotations of Irish poets. And indeed, in the aftermath of his success in the election, he spoke to me very warmly, affectionately, almost emotionally about his heritage and the lessons and values that came down through the generations of an Irish household in Scranton. And he speaks very fondly of both County Louth in Ireland and County Mayo, where both maternal and paternal great-grandparents came from. Mm. There's a genuineness there. There's a real decency there that comes across. And I think that is very much appreciated by all generations in Ireland.
Very quickly and personally, I wanted to ask you, obviously there's always an eagerness to be the first international head of state to meet the American president, head of government. Do you think you will be the first? You're going to Ireland, to the White House rather, for St. Patrick's Day in March?
Well, there'll be no decisions made in relation to that. I did invite President Biden to Ireland and he rather jokingly said to me, try and keep me out. But in relation to Patrick's Day, of course, that's an honoured tradition in the relationship between Ireland and the United States. Obviously, COVID may very well have an impact on that. So our officials will engage and we'll do what's safe and what's best. But I do think both of us are very keen to cement that very historic relationship between the United States of America and Ireland, which goes back through the ages now. It's an important relationship in the modern era. It has cultural and artistic manifestations. It has economic manifestations. And of course, in the context of Ireland's membership of the European Union, we do see ourselves very much as potential bridge builders between the US and the European Union.
OK, Okay, so that's interesting. I first want to ask you about COVID, though, because obviously President Biden's first priority is to get hold of this coronavirus pandemic as it affects his country. And you, obviously, in Ireland and all the other countries have been trying to do the same. You know, you went from one of the best prepared, one of the best results in Europe to now one of the highest rates in the world. What happened? And do you think there are lessons learned? Because obviously many say that the, loosening up of restrictions over Christmas, allowing everybody to meet, has put you in a very difficult and dangerous position right now.
Yes, I mean, I think we had been doing very well. We had a very severe lockdown in October and November for the full month of November, which did have very significant impact on bringing the virus levels down. Prior to that, you know, we've been on a series of restrictions right throughout last year. And certainly the socialization that came with opening up has been a factor in a very significant spike. We also have the new UK variant of the virus in Ireland, which has also driven numbers. It's now up to about 62% of all cases, which is a worry. And then, of course, the seasonality factor as well, some say, has impacted. So we are in a very difficult situation right now in the third wave, but we've immediately gone into lockdown during Christmas week, essentially, and that is having an impact now in terms of the case numbers coming down significantly, and indeed the close contacts all in the right direction. However, the pressure on our hospitals and on our ICUs is intense, and our frontline workers are performing heroically now at the moment. And I think last evening we had a meeting of the European Union prime ministers, and genuine concern across the continent in terms of the potential damaging impact of new variants and also this third wave as the vaccination program has been rolled out in parallel. So, yeah, one is always learning lessons throughout this pandemic. It is a deadly virus. It's an evolving virus. We need vigilance, and I think globally we need to work in harmony in terms of suppressing the virus, because we are only safe when everybody is safe across the globe.
Right.
And we have to take a global perspective on it, and we appreciate President Biden's leadership on that front.
Yeah, and that might make a difference. We wait to see that, of course, because the US, with its convening power and its ability to really sort of coordinate a global response, has been sorely missed over the past 4 years. But can I ask you, because you mentioned the British variant, the UK variant. Today, the British Prime Minister suggested that scientific advisors are saying that it could be much more lethal than they at first believed. They knew it was more spreadable, more transmissible, but it may be more lethal. What are you hearing about that? And given how it's affecting your country, what do you think is going to have to be done?
Well, that worries me greatly because, as you correctly say, the research to date was suggesting it was more transmissible, but that it wasn't any more damaging from a health perspective than the wild virus. So I am concerned about that because, as I've said, it is becoming the dominant variant in Ireland now in terms of case numbers. And so that is why we are in a very severe lockdown right now. And we will be continuing those measures for the foreseeable future. And we'll be seeing what else we can do to continue to suppress the numbers. We will obviously be in touch with British scientists in terms of understanding the latest to emerge. I'm conscious that the British Prime Minister has made that statement this evening, and we will have to get further information from British science in relation to that.
For instance, your own chief medical officer, chief medical advisor, even before this statement about the new variant, suggested that there needed to be tougher restrictions on travel. Do you plan to impose border controls to somehow restrict travel to Ireland?
Yes, there will be further measures to... first of all, we are saying to people, please don't travel to Ireland unless for essential purposes right now. And we're saying to Irish people, do not travel outside of Ireland. Don't travel beyond 5 kilometres. We have a 5 kilometre limit now within the country, so there's no need to be travelling abroad. You shouldn't be unless for absolutely essential purposes. And likewise, people who are intending to come into Ireland You should not really travel right now unless you have essential purposes for so doing. But we will be looking at a range of measures on Monday in relation to travel. Already we have an obligation on anybody travelling into Ireland to have a PCR negative test prior to coming in, and failure to do so could result in fines and so on, but also now quarantining. We're looking at that in terms of a decision on Monday, but also further decisions to restrict travel into the country.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you, because you mentioned, you know, obviously vaccination and the vaccine is the way out of this, and for everybody, you know, everybody has to be safe. It can't be just one country or another. There have been issues with supply, both here in the UK, which has got quite a good record on vaccinating the population. Better, I mean, 6% versus 2% in Ireland. But the EU is concerned also. It hasn't even approved yet, and that might not happen till the end of the month, the AstraZeneca vaccine. Do you see any worrying, concerning structural problems with getting the vaccine out in a timely way, again, as they're trying to do in the United States now?
The issue for us is the delivery of the vaccine into the country. We've been very dependent so far on the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. We have some volumes in from Moderna. We are waiting for authorization for AstraZeneca, which applied for authorization, I think, back on the 11th of January. And that is due at the end of this month, with a delivery timeline at the moment for mid-February. What we anticipate is that in quarter two of the year, the issue will move from being one of vaccine delivery issue to one of administration of the vaccine on a mass population basis. We have done a lot of preparatory work through our national task force and our health service executive in relation to detailed plans for mass vaccination of our population. And we have made some significant advances on that. The issue right now is getting enough vaccine into the country. By Sunday, we will have vaccinated all the senior residents of our long-term healthcare facilities and the staff there, and about half of all frontline healthcare workers. They will be next then to complete that, the frontline healthcare workers, and then into the over 70 age cohort. But that's very much dependent on obtaining delivery of the vaccines into the country. The latter half of the first 6 months, I think we will have a sufficiency of supply of vaccines. January, February and March, we have not a sufficiency of vaccine delivery from the companies. Obviously, that's work in progress.
Yeah. Can I just switch gears now to a pretty huge trauma that your country has undergone? Just last week, the report on the mother and baby's homes after a five-year investigation came out, and it's truly shocking about the trauma, about the death that took place over a period of 80 years in those homes around Ireland. Just some of the figures: 9,000 children are known to have died at these homes, funded by the state over that period. Last one closed in 1998. And we want to show this picture now, which is quite shocking and really is shows what happened. The Irish Examiner, the day after the report was released, look at that. It is full of the names of 900 children who died at just one of these homes. Look at that. Look at those names. It's really hard to fathom. You did issue an apology. You called it a shameful chapter. But there are many people who don't believe you went far enough and made it sort of a whole of society issue rather than the church. Can you tell me, just tell me where you stand on this?
Well, no, I'm very clear, and I was very clear in my apology and indeed in other statements. First of all, this was a very shameful chapter in Ireland's history, and the church bears a very heavy responsibility, as does the state. And I made that clear in my apology. The state did not protect its citizens, did not protect the mothers or indeed the babies or children who were born in these homes. The very fact that women were stigmatized in such a way was appalling and shocking, and had its roots in what I would call a perverse moral code, a perverse attitude to sexuality, that really was just that is impossible to comprehend, and did enormous damage to people. And what I did say was that, you know, actions speak louder than words, and I'm repulsed by the entire experience, and I think we have to now do everything we possibly can in present day society to make amends, and in particular to make sure that the mothers and children involved have full access to information. And that is a real, the children born in these homes, they want access to their information, and that is what we're going to provide. We're also going to tell the story nationally in terms of a repository of records, but also to in the voices of the survivors and the victims, that they would tell the story, that future generations would learn of this very shameful part of our history. And it speaks to the horror of institutionalization as well. Right throughout the decades and the 30s and the 40s, the high death rates of babies in these institutions was not commented upon or acted upon by the state, even though reports were sent back by inspectors and so on. There was no action taken, and that was wrong. And I think the role of the religious it was equally wrong, and in an appalling way, an appalling cruelty visited on so many people over such a long time.
And to that point, I want to play this little bit of an interview from one of the survivors, PJ Haverty. He was born in one of the homes, and this is what he said about the report itself.
I was very annoyed that they came out with this society were the cause, and the family were the cause of pushing their women into the homes here, and that the church and the state and had nothing got to do with. And to me, that's totally wrong, because the priest came down to my mother's house and he laid down the law. And he was the one that told the parents to bring her into Joom here.
It is shocking, and clearly there are many who don't believe that their, you know, trauma has been addressed. Is there anything more that needs to be done to address complaints by survivors like PJ?
Yes, I mean, we are also looking at a restorative recognition scheme as well, which is being designed at the moment by a number of government departments led by our Minister for Children, Roderick O'Gorman, as I said, to make amends and to recognise the trauma that those born, and in particular the mothers that they went through. We'll be doing that along with other measures that have been recommended. And we're committed to doing that in an urgent and effective way, but all the time putting the survivor first, listening to the survivor, their concerns, their needs, and indeed their desires in terms of making amends and recognizing what went on for what it was, and also to learn lessons from it in terms of future public policy in relation to a whole range of issues. I mentioned institutionalization, the importance of education for all, and particularly those on the margins. And what PJ said there was correct. I mean, if you read the report, and particularly the personal testimonies, you know, the priest does loom large and is hugely influential in the earlier decades. A doctor looms large in terms of going to the home and making arrangements that the young mother would be brought to one of these mother and baby homes. And in some instances, the young mother would have been a victim of rape or incest, and no one again raised those very fundamental moral and criminal issues with anyone in authority. So it was quite shocking. There's no hiding away from that or hiding the role of state or church in this. Reference has been made to broader society. There is a societal context to this as well, but without question, it's that what I feel most when you read through it is this sort of religious moral code, this kind of judgmentalism, and this sense of the righteous knowing what's best for everybody. And it's just morally wrong what happened, an abomination in my view. Yeah, no one commented at, you know, people didn't raise it at in the various decades, particularly in the 40s, where the majority, very high numbers in the 40s, for example, in the 1940s, and wasn't, no, state authorities did not intervene to arrest that high mortality rate, much higher than anything outside of the homes, in terms of infant mortality, and a real act of negligence in respect of those babies and those children.
Prime Minister Micheál Martin, thank you for joining us from Dublin. Now, some of President Biden's toughest tests will come from the Middle East, a very different place than the one he knew as vice president. A groundbreaking film, The Human Factor, looks at Israeli-Palestinian peace efforts through the eyes of key American negotiators. It is not a dry, boring history lesson. It's personal, about the people and the humanity, all vital to making peace. Here's a clip from the trailer.
It was history in the making. The idea of breaking through that taboo was just unbelievable.
And I can see that something changes in the relationship.
They had moved from being adversaries to partners in peace.
We say to you today, in a loud and a clear voice, enough of blood and tears. Enough!
Dror Morey is the Israeli director of this film. He's joining me from Tel Aviv. And also with me are two of the key players featured in the film, veteran Middle East negotiator for several administrations, Aaron David Miller, and the former senior advisor, Egyptian-American Gamal Hilal, who joins us from Cairo in Egypt. Welcome both of you to the program, all three of you rather. Dror, can I ask you first, tell us about the title, the name of the film. What did you mean, the human factor?
Well, we tend to think that normally in those kind of situation of negotiations, the issues, the topics are the most important things. And for me, going through the hours and hours of interviews while I was condensing and trying to build a narrative, what came out very, very vividly is the importance of the human factor, the importance of the personal relationship between the leaders and how they related to each other. So in a way, the sense of, you know, we deal with a lot of subjects which are very, very tough, Jerusalem, the right of return, the refugees. And at the end of the day, it's about two people who meet and need to deal with each other and need to reach a deal between themselves. And I actually wanted to tell the story from the point of view of the professionals, from the people that were there inside the room with those leaders, as they tried to reach peace. And for me, the most important thing was what went wrong. And what came vividly, very, very apparently inside the interviews and inside the movie is the impact of the human factor.
Well, it really does come out vividly. It's an amazing film. And the fact that you got all these negotiators together to talk about it in ways that we haven't heard before is very revealing. So, Aaron David Miller, we've talked a lot before on this program. You were one of the senior negotiators for many, many years. Do you agree that the human factor may not have been there enough? Do you think that the American negotiators had enough empathy, particularly for the Palestinians, when you were being the so-called third-party honest brokers?
I mean, the humanity with respect to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, perhaps more than any of the conflicts between Israel and the Arab states, I think is a critically important consideration. And I think Dror was onto something. Of course, it's national interests ultimately that will determine whether or not an agreement is made. But men and women who factor in that conflict, clearly, and the role of personality is critically important. As far as the American involvement, I think, frankly, we got too close to both parties. I think we began to see the world the way we wanted it to be, rather than the way it was. In a very controversial, provocative line in the film, I quoted Henry Kissinger in his memoirs. He referred to the United States, or at least his refusal to become what he called Israel's lawyer. In my own judgment, I realize all the arguments as to why we needed to adopt a position, particularly because Israel controlled the territory. But I really do believe, with respect to the human factor, that we should have been a lawyer for both sides. Our client needed to be the agreement, and we had to be careful not to lawyer for one side or the other. I think we did, in fact, get too close to the Israelis. That may well have been a function of the fact that they control the territory and our sensibility that we needed, certainly on the security side, to take their requirements into account. But with the exception of Gamal and Rob Malley, who is not here with us today, I think that, and perhaps Dan Kurtzer also in the film, We really needed, I think, to better understand what were the needs and the requirements of the Palestinian side. And Gamal points out repeatedly that what was important to Palestinians above all was respect. We tried, but I'm not sure we delivered.
Well, let me ask Gamal, and actually it's why I wanted to have Gamal on the program today, because you are one of the rare Arab negotiators in, or Arab-American negotiators, and you were sort of given the job, so to speak, of keeping the Palestinians on side and being the interface mostly with them. So do you think that the human factor was somewhat missing? Do you agree? Because what David Ahrens just said is pretty amazing, that he agrees that America was too much Israel's lawyer. Did that come across to you as well?
No, I might disagree with my good friend Aaron Miller on this one. The issue is that I looked at the human factor at two different levels. One is basically the interrelationship between the negotiators and the leaders and all of that, trying to find a way out and a solution to a very complicated political problem. The part which we might have ignored a little bit was the human factor away from the negotiators and the government officials. In other words, preparing the public in order to be receptive and more supportive and encouraging to the idea of Arab-Israeli peace and all the Palestinian-Israeli peace. But in general, what we try to do is look at what is possible. And as Aaron mentioned, yes, Israel controlled the territories, controlled the land, they have the upper hand. So the idea of trying to work with the Israelis and try to find the best possible outcome that might lead to a solution, it might appear to some people as if we are Israel's lawyers, but the reality is we knew what things that could work and what things could not work. And I think the best example we have seen during the last 4 years, if you looked at the Trump administration and the people who were in charge of Arab-Israeli negotiations or Palestinian-Israeli negotiations, they were all Jewish. They were all trying to basically throw away the elements that the conflict was based on. And they basically did everything that no Israeli government will ever dreamt of, moving the embassy, sort of like throwing the Palestinian Authority under the bus and not recognizing that. So if you compare the two, we certainly were not anybody's lawyers. We tried to work with the political elements that we had at the time, with the human elements that we had to deal with, and we tried to do the best we can. But there is one element which I think we fell short. We have believed in the idea that no normalization comes before a Palestinian-Israeli agreement. And I think that was our mistake. And that is where credits are due to the Trump administration, because although they have not touched or solved the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, but they were able to break the taboo that Arabs and Israelis can actually have normal relationships. And at the end of the day, that would lead to the benefit of the Palestinians. Maybe that we were sort of like short on that particular aspect. And I hope that the Biden administration would focus on this, because the Palestinians don't need a boycott in order to get what they believe is theirs.
So I'm going to come to that in a bit, but I want to just re-rack a little bit and ask Dror, because I believe, Dror, your birthday is on November 4th, which was the day that Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated in 1995. And with it, many say, went the last greatest hope for a peace deal. Tell me about Yitzhak Rabin and you. Tell me about how you featured him in this film, because he really does play one of the most leading roles.
Look, for me, the assassination of Rabin was meant the beginning of the collapse of all the peace process, and the height of that was in the Camp David when it collapsed completely. Rabin was a brave man. He was a leader that was willing to take challenges and take risks for peace. And there is an amazing story which Dennis Ross is telling in the beginning of the movie, or the beginning of the era of Rabin, where he says that he met him just after he became prime minister in his office. And Rabin tells him that He is willing to go for peace, but he is happy that all his boys, as he calls them, are in the army, are with him in the army, the commanders of the army. And when Dennis asks him, why is it so important that those men are with you, Rabin gives a chilling answer to that and says, because when I reach the point where I will have to give the Palestinian what I need to give, I'm afraid there's going to be a civil war. And he almost predicted exactly what almost happened in Israel, where at the height of the demonstration against Rabin, at the height of the Oslo process, there was almost a civil war in Israel. And because of that rift, basically Rabin was assassinated. So for me, the 4th of November 1995, my birthday, was really the last day of hope that I had, in a way, for really trying to achieve peace. And we are downhill from that day on until today.
Well, let's go back to when there was more hope, and that was during the Oslo period. It was when Aaron David Miller and Dennis and Gamal and Clinton and the Oslo process was at least giving some hope. And I want to play a little clip. The only clip that we have from the film that we can play is actually Dennis Ross, the chief member of the team, talking about how Rabin didn't really have much respect or time for Arafat until he started watching him implement difficult decisions that were difficult for the PLO leader to implement under Oslo. And particularly there was one instance where there was a bit of an argument about whether there was going to be a Palestinian police headquarters near the very sensitive city of Hebron. Here's Dennis Ross describing how that was handled.
The president has, next to the Oval Office, a small dining room. So we go over there. And I explain the issue. And before Rabin can say anything, Arafat says, "What's ever acceptable to the prime minister?" Just like that. And Rabin looks at me, looks at him, and he says, "We will have a police station there." And they shake hands, and that was it.
Aaron David Miller, let me ask you about that, because it really was a profound moment. And as Dror says, it's almost like been downhill ever since the assassination of Rabin. Talk to me about how those two, for a while, had a close relationship or partnership in peace.
I mean, Dror and Dennis are right about this, and I know Gamal would agree that Rabin had a fundamental mistrust of Arafat in the beginning. And I think he came to the conclusion that the only option, frankly, was a direct negotiation with the PLO. Jordan was not an option, and West Bankers and Gazans were too weak and divided to provide credible interlocutors. But their relationship changed, and it was, in fact, in response to Rabin's perception. Whether he ever actually accepted Arafat as a partner is arguable. But he did respect Arafat's capacity to actually make tough decisions and to do hard things. And there's no doubt that Rabin's assassination, provided the critical high point, frankly, low point, but until that time, Oslo was on track.
Well, let me ask you, Gamal, let me ask you, I'm going to play this soundbite from actually an interview that I conducted with Jared Kushner in the Trump version of the Palestinian-Israeli peace plan. And this is what he told me about the Palestinians. Just take a listen.
If they screw up this opportunity, which again, they have a perfect track record of missing opportunities, if they screw this up, I think that they will have a very hard time looking the international community in the face, saying they're victims, saying they have rights. This is a great deal for them. If they come to the table and negotiate, I think they can get something excellent.
So, Gamal, this is before the normalization that you just talked about with the other Arab states and countries. This was about, you know, the peace process, or the Trump peace plan, that, as you mentioned, pretty much gave the whole ball of wax to Israel. What do you make of this constant refrain that Palestinians never miss a chance to miss a chance?
Well, there is some truth to this. There were so many opportunities in the past that offered themselves, and the Palestinians did act either too late or never. I think it all started when President Sadat and Egypt. Egypt put the foundation for the idea of peace between Israelis and Israelis and the Arabs. And at that time, you probably recall that Camp David won with President Sadat and Begin. It put the foundation for a possible Palestinian self-government. And the number of settlements obviously was much, much less. That an opportunity that was lost. There were so many other opportunities in the process that were also lost. But I don't think that this could be the foundation for future possibilities between the Israelis and the Palestinians. I think the Palestinians have matured and they have learned their lessons. They believe, and I'm in contact with them all the time, they believe also that the Clinton parameters was a missed opportunity. Camp David was a missed opportunity, but they are not the only party to be blamed for Camp David. The Israelis are equally to be blamed for it. But the point here is that if you wanted to ignore the elements of the conflict that would lead to a conflict resolution between the Palestinians and the Israelis, then you can do anything you wanted to do, like Mr. Kushner, what Mr. Kushner did. But what Mr. Kushner did in terms of bypassing the actual conflict, ignoring conflict resolution, ignoring conflict management, and simply go into normalization, the country was a little bit, the region was a little bit ripe for that. There is also an element of fatigue that some of the Arab countries have been waiting for the Palestinians for decades. Nothing ever moved. And I think that normalization between Arab countries and Israel will, at the end of the day, benefit the Palestinians and their efforts to reach a resolution to their conflict.
Well, it'd be really interesting to see how that unfolds. I wish we had more time to discuss. The film is great. Dror Morey, Aaron David Miller, Gamal, thank you so much for joining us. And The Human Factor opens in limited theaters today. And next, we are going to talk about more on the global pandemic. No one is fully safe until all are indeed. President Biden has unveiled a new national strategy to replace the ad hoc jumble of responses from 50 different states under the previous administration. Andy Slavitt is a senior advisor to the new response team, and he was President Obama's acting chief of Medicare and Medicaid. Here he is now talking to our Hari Srinivasan about the best way forward.
Christian, thanks. Andy Slavitt, thanks for joining us. First, last time we spoke, you were on the outside looking in. Here you are now, part of the group of people advising the president on our COVID response. And first, I guess, you know, there's been some rumors and reports about what your group has inherited. Is there a plan? Was there a plan? Is it a half-baked plan? What are you working with?
Well, you know, I don't want to fixate too much on the negative, because I think one of the president's objectives is, of course, to bring the country together. And to do that, we don't want to look too far backwards. But, you know, I think there's a reason why things aren't as far along as we thought. I don't think there's the kind of infrastructure and the plan to for success that there needs to be. Now, plans aren't everything. Plans need to be tweaked along the way, and we'll need to respond to facts on the ground and changes in science and all that, but you know, we are going to have to put in place, and we are starting to put in place, a very clear, detailed plan of how we're going to do things and how we're going to do things like increase vaccinations, and I think that's what the American public expects.
You know, we'll talk about vaccinations in a minute. I want to also ask, right now people are very concerned about these new variants that occur naturally, that are happening in different parts of the world, even different parts of our country. A variant in Los Angeles, there's been one found in the Bay Area. These seem more contagious than what we've been accustomed to for months and months. How concerned is the task force and the response planning for these variants?
Well, you're right. There are new variants. There will be new variants. You know, this will be a part of the story of this pathogen. And we just have to be better and smarter. What I would say to the public is the same things that were important before we knew about these variants: wearing a mask, as good a, and as tight-fitting a mask as possible, getting vaccinated and understanding that why you should get vaccinated, and taking precautions with yourself and your family are just as important, if not more important, than before. So in terms of what we would do differently as a public, it's all exactly the same. Now, the scientific community, and we're going to let the science continue to tell us what the data says about these things, is going to have to be on its, continue to be on its game. You know, it's not develop a vaccine, game over. It's continue to look for vaccines, therapies, other adjustments to tests and so forth that will naturally occur over time. And I think the good news is if we are on top of it and get more on top of it, start sequencing more, start testing more, we will not be caught as unaware as I think we were this time.
If this virus mutates, and that's bound to happen, is there a scenario where we just live with coronavirus year after year, and similar to getting a flu shot, we get a coronavirus shot too?
Well, so, you know, I don't want to be too much speculate about the future, but I think if you look at the history of viruses, you know, very few are completely eradicated. So smallpox was eradicated. And you know, polio is quite close. But most viruses, we learn to find many, many other means besides just eradication for dealing with. And as we know, sometimes that means booster shots, as in the case of influenza. Sometimes in the case of HIV, that means cocktails of therapeutics. But we will absolutely be able to bring this under control over time and get back to normal life. But we need a strategy to do it. We need science. We need to pay attention to the science. We need transparency. We need to get facts. And if we do those things and really act and get the public to act with us, you know, we will do the best job we can defeating this. And whether what defeating means exactly, as you say, Harry, we don't exactly know what that looks like, but it probably doesn't mean complete eradication.
So what happens if the president says, we've got the Defense Production Act going? Does that mean that somebody from the White House right now is making calls to glove manufacturers, PPE manufacturers, and saying, hey, listen, I need you to put your assembly lines for other things on hold and make more of these, and we want them by yesterday?
So those are the assessments being made exactly. And I think as those things get determined and figured out precisely what we need and where we need it, we will see those things. I'll give you an example, an immediate example. People may be aware that there is an extra a dose of the Pfizer vaccine, that what they call a sixth dose. Well, we've needed to create, we needed to ramp up production of a new syringe, and that's one of the things that we are ramping up using Defense Production Act. I expect we will use it aggressively. And I'd say if I had a message to corporations out there who have capacity, whether it's to produce vaccines, whether it's to produce anything else in the national good, you know, identify yourself to us. We're already deeply in conversations with many, but we need to pull the whole country together, not just corporations, not just states, not just the federal government. We need to pull as many people together, and we'll defeat this thing more quickly.
How do you change the culture for millions of people who still find this an intrusion on their personal freedoms?
I think we have to listen. You know, I don't think that we should be in a position where we're treating people's concerns as unreasonable. Whether they're concerns about the vaccine, whether they're concerns about wearing a mask, whether they're concerns about their small businesses, their bars, their restaurants. So for one, I think we can't build trust until we do that. Number two, we have to keep up our end of the bargain. And by us, I mean the government. So in other countries where the government provides some support for small businesses, for people who are out of work, for renters, et cetera, that level of trust gets reciprocated more easily than the situation we face here, where people have really had to wonder too much. That's why the president's package, the $1.9 billion package everyone talks about to help this country recover, is so critical, because it in fact supports people through a very difficult process, but it also communicates to people that we will have your back. We know you're going through difficult times. We know we are asking things of you. We know this is sacrifice, but asking people to sacrifice is far different than not asking them and letting people to stew and make them think that they're losing things.
Now, when we spoke last, and you've written about this often, you think that we can get this under control if we just gave it a solid month, maybe a little bit more. Is that part of the plan?
So I think if we adopt the measures that we are all contemplating, 100 days wearing a mask, getting vaccines into 100 million arms in the first 100 days, which has plenty of challenges, but we are want to do that and even more, and to communicate with people in a way that they believe and that they trust about the real data, about real dangers, about health risks, about all of those things, we will make a dramatic impact. Now, things will change and we'll see surprises. We'll see things like a variant, or we'll run into supply challenges. You know, this will not be smooth. It'll be a bumpy road, but we will inform people along the way of the good, of the challenges. And I hope that people come to equate this administration with complete transparency and the hard work it takes to get to that place.
One of the Republican pushbacks has been 100 million seems too few, because if you actually just say 100 million arms, looking at the fact that most people have to get two shots, that's just about 50 million people. What do you do after that? Because that's where we are in the production pipeline. What do you tell Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, anybody else to say we need more vaccines fast?
So first of all, the commitment that the president made was to have 100 million vaccines in arms within 100 days. That was made before we had any idea whether or not this was even possible. But I think it sent a signal that we have to set goals and we have to achieve them. We have to deliver them. Or if we don't, we have to explain what's going on. But we have to pledge ourselves to do that. What it doesn't mean is that we have a goal of getting to 100 million vaccines and stopping. We have to get vaccines available as quickly as possible to every American who wants them and as many places who want them. That's why we're rolling out these federal centers. We're rolling out 100 federal centers that are going to distribute and deliver vaccines. That's why we're ramping up with the pharmacy. That's why we are going to be working with the governors to help figure out where are the vaccines in their pipeline, how do we improve them, and working with the manufacturers to figure out, can we get every additional dose possible? It's going to take some time. It's not the kind of thing that can be done overnight. You know, the vision that we all may have had when we heard about from the last administration that there were hundreds of millions ready that were being produced early on. You know, unfortunately, it's not as, that's not the case we inherited. But it is what it is. We take where we are and we do everything we can to get as many vaccines out into people as possible.
So right now, speaking of that pipeline, less than half the vaccine that's been distributed, I think it's about 36 million to states, has been injected. So how do we speed that up? I mean, where's the bottleneck here? Is it the federal government not getting it to states fast enough? Is it the states not getting it to the hospitals? The hospitals not getting it into patients? What's the problem?
So I'll start with this. States are frustrated about a couple things. One is many of them want more vaccines. All of them want at least predictability to know how many vaccines they're getting. They haven't gotten that. We need to turn that around and give that to them. That's one of the changes we can make to them. More predictability, and then ramp up doses and give them as much transparency as possible. Then we have to look at the same time, what's happening to those vaccines as they go out the door. Because we know that, as you say, not every one of them is getting instantly into an arm. So there's some things we can do. We can open the aperture so that we can get more people eligible for vaccines, because some of it may rightly be that the rules are too complicated, that we have vaccines, but they're being held for a too narrow population. Some of it is some natural mismatch that's going to occur. For example, you know, you may have to send batches to rural communities or to federally qualified health centers. Now, they may not be able to as efficiently use all the vaccines they get. But it's still important, Hari, because the thing that we can't fall down on is making sure that the distribution is equitable. And so if we put all the vaccines in one hard to locate place, we could probably vaccinate more people more quickly. But the people that can't get to that place would not be vaccinated. And those would largely be people of color, low-income people, et cetera. So, you know, we're going to have to both be as efficient as possible, but to be as equitable as possible, we're also going to need to balance it.
Is there a data warehouse that is showing you everything you need to see about how the vaccine is absorbed, who's getting it, who's not getting it? Do you have that kind of dashboard? Are you building it now?
Unfortunately, we don't have the infrastructure that I would like to see. And you know, I think we have some things, but we have also gaps in our knowledge that, and the good news is within 24 hours, we identified what those gaps were and called people together. And there are people who have wanted to figure out what they are. But as it sits today, I would love to be able to tell you where every vaccine in the country is in inventory, everything that's been produced, where it is, how it's being distributed, what sites are working, what sites are not working as well, where we need to provide assistance. So we're going to have to partner with the states. And we intend to beginning actually with a conversation we're having with all the governors this coming Tuesday to really make sure that that's happening in an aggressive and systematic way as possible.
Now, speaking of equitable, last night I exchanged a question and answer with Jerome Adams, the former Surgeon General, and he said his dad is 74. He's an African-American, has other comorbidities, but the state that his dad lives in, the age is 75, right? How do you weigh the disparate impact that this virus is having on people of color with comorbidities? And or is the federal government's hands tied because this is a state-by-state issue?
No, we have to work together on solving this problem. That's why we have a health equity task force. That's why we have a leader of the health equity task force that is involved in every decision, every major decision that gets made. Because what happens is, you know, I don't think that the last administration was trying to be inequitable. But I think what we've learned in this country is that unless you make an explicit, specific effort to target people to whom things are harder to reach, and I'm not just talking about vaccine, I'm talking about everything. And I'm not even just talking about the pandemic. I'm talking about all of healthcare. And it's probably not just all of healthcare. Then we know that we fail people. That not everybody has equal access or ability, whether it's transportation or childcare, or they get paid by the hours and can't leave their job. So unless you make an extra effort, you never reach that level of equity. The data that we've seen shows that we have a real problem with vaccine in terms of getting them to the communities of color, that it's going to take a really extended effort. And that's going to mean very specifically working with groups and places that are going to be able to do that.
You know, the president recently said this is going to get worse before it gets better, that we could see 500,000 people dead in another month or so. What should we be bracing for?
Exactly that. These things don't turn on a dime. There will be continued challenges, but we should also brace for the fact that we can make a difference. You know, this isn't a virus that's beyond our imagination or understanding. Yes, we will learn more about it. Yes, there will be new variants, but we have the science, and what we need is the will and the support and the unity to come together and do those things. Every time I hear one of those numbers, I hear it two ways. I hear it as a sense of how awful this is and what the human toll has been, but I also hear it as a challenge to not let that happen, to make every death theoretically one of the last ones, because the only way to honor people who we've lost, in my mind, the best way to honor people we've lost, not the only way, is to not lose many more people.
Andy Slavitt, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is it for now. Thank you for watching and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.